Now we'll welcome in Bob Costas. Bob,
hey guys.
How are you today?
Good. I've read everything that Kurt has written, except this, because this must have just come out, right?
It did just come out. I think you said about a week ago.
I'm a week behind.
We have faith that you'll catch up. Don't worry about that.
I will eventually. Good airplane reading.
So, Bob, here we are at Hall of Fame weekend. Do you make it a point to get here for every Hall of Fame induction?
Well, not everyone, although since the advent of the Baseball Network, and this is the third year of MLBN, we do come up each weekend because it's a great time to get interviews with Hall of Famers. We just set up in the Ballplayers Hotel, the Otisaga Hotel, and we just bring as many of them through for extensive interviews as we can, and we play them in the off season as part of the Studio 42 series.
Bob, what's your favorite part of the weekend?
I think it's really, although the ceremonies themselves are significant and often moving, I think it's really the camaraderie that you see among the Hall of Famers, spanning the generations, whether it's a young guy just in like Roberto Alomar or someone like Red Shaindienst or Yogi Berra. It's a fraternity. There's a common understanding. There's a mutual respect. It's one of the most exclusive fraternities, not just in sports, but of any kind, anywhere. And the sense of real respect for the game and appreciation for what this honor means and what Cooperstown and the Hall of Fame means is universal among these guys.
Bob, we saw you as you were walking over here, talking with some fans, taking pictures, signing autographs. Did you ever imagine yourself signing autographs in Cooperstown, New York, on a weekend when so many Hall of Famers are in here? And when you yourself were a young kid idolizing Mickey Mantle and the great players of that era?
No, of course, I never thought of that possibility. But one thing I've always been mindful of, and I'm certainly not comparing myself in standing to these people, but if when I was a young guy, if I had asked when I was 16, 17 years old, if I had encountered Mel Allen or Red Barber or Lindsey Nelson or Vin Scully and had wanted a word with them, I would have hoped that they would have had a word for me, and it would have meant a lot to me. So I try as much as possible to acknowledge if someone has some interest in you, then you want to reciprocate. You know, you can't necessarily spend an hour with every person. You'd miss the plane, you know, or whatever your next appointment is. But as much as possible, you want to show that if they appreciate you, you appreciate that.
Ricky Sobrano and Kevin Price here on One-on-One, joined right now by Bob Costas. Out of three inductees this year, Burt Blyleven, Roberto Alomar, and Pat Gillick. What's your fondest memory of each of them?
Well, in the case of Roberto Alomar, Tom Verducci put it very well in Sports Illustrated, as he almost always puts everything very well. He said he had the feet of a ballet dancer and the hands of a jeweler. He was an artist out there at second base. Switch hitter as well at the plate, could hit with power on occasion, hit for high averages, stole bases, could do everything. He wasn't just a clear Hall of Famer. He's in the discussion among the tiny handful of greatest players ever to play his position. And I guess if you had to pick one thing, although I wasn't directly involved in it, just as a baseball fan, a memory, he hit a crucial home run off Dennis Eckersley in the 1992 American League Championship Series, a ninth-inning home run, late afternoon, shadows moving across the field, tough to pick up the ball, especially against a guy like Eckersley, sent the game to extra innings. The Blue Jays won in 11. The A's at that time had won three straight pennants, and they were the reigning power of the American League. That home run turned the series and got the Jays into the World Series, where they won the first of their two titles. So that's probably the second most important homer after Joe Carter's homer in the history of the Blue Jays. As far as Burt Blyleven is concerned, I don't know if it's one specific memory, but that knee-bending curveball. You just don't see very many guys throw a big curveball like that. A lot of times you're watching the game, and even with the center field camera, you think, well, that's a breaking ball of some kind. You knew when Burt Blyleven threw the curveball. It was a true classic. And as far as Pat Gillick is concerned, here's a guy who, if you're going to put an executive in, this is as close to a no-brainer as you could ever find. He didn't just win championships with the Blue Jays, but he, in essence, built the organization from an expansion team to a team that, before the game's economics turned on them, was really one of the consistent powers in baseball. And then he went on to Baltimore, and while they didn't win the World Series, they were a contender in the late 90s when he was their general manager. Then in Seattle, he presides over a team that wins 116 games, and this is after Randy Johnson and Alex Rodriguez have left. They win 116 games in 2001, and then he caps it off with the Phillies, and they win the World Championship in 2008. So as far as Pat Gillick is concerned, they don't come much better than that.
Neither Alomar nor Blylevin, especially Blylevin, this being his 14th year on the ballot, made it in early in the process or on the first ballot. Do you think they had to wait too long, and do you think there's too much emphasis put on being a first-ballot Hall of Famer?
Roberto Alomar waited 1 year just because of the spitting incident with John Hirschbeck. That was the way that some of the writers could slap him on the wrist, even though they fully intended to vote for him eventually. Because on merit, Roberto Alomar was a no-questions-asked Hall of Famer. That's not to minimize the incident with Hirschbeck. It was horrible. It was uncharacteristic for Alomar, but it was horrible. And he has apologized many times over, and he hasn't tried to minimize it. And he and Hirschbeck are now good friends. He invited Hirschbeck to be here this weekend, but John is working, still an active umpire. Otherwise, he said he would have been there. They've teamed up on some charity ventures. He said that Hirschbeck was among the first people to call him when he didn't get in a year ago. And Hirschbeck said, I know the reason you didn't get in, and we both regret that that incident happened. And John was also among the first to call him when he did get in this year. So that's the reason in Robbie's case. In Blylevin's case, no one has ever come from a smaller percentage on the first ballot to eventually getting in. He got only 17.5% the first time he was on the ballot. I don't mean any disrespect to Burt Blylevin or anyone else who's in the Hall of Fame. Whoever you think is the least worthy Hall of Famer is still a very, very, very good baseball player. However, there was a time when the Hall of Fame was about the greatest of the great. When I was your age and we talked about Hall of Famers, we didn't think of borderline players. We knew that Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Mickey Mantle and Roberto Clemente and Sandy Koufax and Bob Gibson were Hall of Famers. The borderline players were guys that you wouldn't even think twice about now. You know, we would have drawn the line in a different place. What's happened now is that any potential Hall of Famer is going to be compared to whoever is the least worthy guy who's now in. And on that basis, you could make a case for dozens and dozens of guys presently playing or retired and not yet in. So I think the whole thing has been blurred. And one of the few things that remains, although they hold the line on this less than they used to answer your question, is the concept of a first ballot Hall of Famer. To me, that still matters. That it's a small distinction, but a meaningful one. If you're a first ballot Hall of Famer, then you belong in that celestial grouping. You belong with those true immortals. If you've got to wait beyond the first ballot, unless there's a unique circumstance like the Roberto Alomar situation, if you've got to wait beyond the first ballot, maybe you deserve to be here, but maybe you're in a slightly different category.
Speaking of making distinctions of sorts, to this point, the writers have kept steroid users, convicted steroid users, out of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think steroid users, like Barry Bonds as an example, belong in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I fall into this group with that. I think that someone like Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds, who clearly would have been a first ballot, near unanimous Hall of Famer had they retired before ever ingesting anything more potent than a protein shake. If they had both left the game in the late 1990s, there's no question that Roger Clemens is one of the greatest pitchers of all time. There's no question that Barry Bonds is not just a Hall of Famer, but he's in the discussion among the greatest modern players. So I would, if I had a vote, and as you know, only writers do, broadcasters don't, if I had a vote, I would withhold it from Bonds and Clemens for a year or two, but ultimately I would vote for them. There are others who I have high respect for, like Tom Verducci, who I mentioned earlier. Tom's an absolutist. He says if there is either proof or overwhelming circumstantial evidence that somebody was a steroid user, even for just a portion of their career, no matter how great they were without performance-enhancing drugs, he would never vote for them, which, unless he changes his mind, means that not only will he never vote for Bonds or Clemens, he'll never vote for Alex Rodriguez. And then there are guys who are in an entirely separate category. You could make a very good case that without performance-enhancing drugs, Sammy Sosa would never be in the Hall of Fame discussion. No knowledgeable baseball fan thinks that Sammy Sosa belongs in the same sentence with Frank Robinson, even though he has more home runs than Frank Robinson. So with Sammy Sosa, I'd never vote for him. Rafael Palmeiro is an interesting case because, well, he might say, well, I thought I was taking a B12 shot or whatever I only used toward the end of my career. We can't be sure about that. And so he's in an area of doubt, and out he goes. I think Mark McGwire, had he been healthy, probably would have put together a Hall of Fame career, but it wouldn't have been anything like the career he had. He's kidding himself if he thinks that all that steroids did for him was to help him get back on the field and that he would have hit 70 home runs on his own merit if he had just been healthy. That's nonsense. That's crazy talk. However, he could have been a Harmon Killebrew type, legitimate power hitter, 270 hitter, 45-50 home run a year guy. So I feel bad for Mark, who's a nice guy, and had he been healthy, probably would have put together a Hall of Fame career. But without performance-enhancing drugs, he doesn't do what he did. And so with regret, I think that Mark McGwire will never get in the Hall of Fame, and if I had a vote, I would never vote for him. So I guess you got three separate categories there.
Ricky Sobrano and Kevin Price here on One-on-One talking to the great Bob Costas. Bob, I know growing up, your idol was Mickey Mantle. Can you even quantify how much he meant to you as a kid growing up in New York?
Well, it's a different era.
Mm-hmm.
And people often make the mistake of stating that I think, or people from my generation think, that ballplayers of the 50s and 60s were superior as people to modern-day ballplayers. That would be beyond naive to think. That would be stupid. Let me state flatly. If steroids were available in the 50s and the 60s and the 20s and the 30s, lots of players would have used them. The same way that they sharpened their spikes, they scuffed baseballs, they threw spitballs if they could, they corked their bats. People are looking for an edge, all right? The issue of steroids is properly viewed as an issue of authenticity of performance, not an issue of morality. How could anyone contend that Ty Cobb was a better human being than Barry Bonds? Mm. Or that Pete Rose is a better person than Mark McGwire? I mean, both Cobb and Rose and other guys had moral failings. However, you can contend that their baseball performances were more authentic. And that has always been my position. That is a logical position. The other position is something that people made up and attributed to me. And I never thought that at any time. Getting back to your question, though, in the 50s and 60s, the game was different. And the way people received the game was different. There was just enough television and radio so that we were more familiar with the players than maybe our parents and grandparents were. But not so much on a 24/7 basis that the romance and the mystique and the quality of imagination was taken out of it. So in that sense, it was a perfect era to fall in love with the game. And we fell in love with the game. And so Mickey Mantle or Hank Aaron or Willie Mays or Roberto Clemente or whoever your guy was represented not just excellence on the field, but represented the way baseball felt in that era. And if you didn't grow up in that era and didn't experience it that way, it's impossible to explain how those players and how the game of that era, the ballparks of that era, got in your imagination and stays with you. Even long after you've left childhood behind, the memory stays with you.
Are there any players in today's game that harken back to that era and inspire those sort of memories, in your opinion?
Oh, there's lots of players today who are completely admirable. I mean, and could have played and excelled in any era. The most obvious one who comes to mind is Derek Jeter. But, you know, I have never looked to ballplayers for moral guidance. You know, I think it's nice if they can keep their name, whatever sport they play, keep their name off the police blotter. I think it's nice if they understand the difference between being a stylish player and being a boorish exhibitionist. I mean, think of all these guys gesturing toward the sky when they get a ground ball single to right field in the sixth inning of a game that's 9-3. The base hit makes them 1-for-4, raises their batting average to .252, and they're making some kind of signal toward someone who's supposedly watching this from heaven. I would think they might have something better to do up in heaven if, in fact, they are there than watch a game that's 9-3 in the sixth inning. All this stuff is just self-aggrandizing nonsense. Who's more stylish? Barry Sanders? Gale Sayers, or some imbecile doing a dance in the end zone? You know, who's more stylish? A guy who hits a three-pointer that makes him 1-for-9 in the game and does a get-me-on-SportsCenter dance? Or Dr. J, Magic Johnson, Jerry West? You know how stylish Willie Mays was? You know how stylish Sandy Koufax and Roberto Clemente were? They oozed style. You could feel it from a mile away. Style is in the performance. Not in the check-me-out peripheral stuff that so many guys are in love with today.
Bob, you've gotten to do pretty much everything a broadcaster could want to do in your career. To this point, what is your marquee moment so far?
Well, baseball's my favorite sport, so I'm always going to put baseball at or near the top. I didn't call the game in either case. Vin Scully did, and you can't get better than Vin Scully, but I was in the Red Sox clubhouse in 86 when the ball went through Buckner's legs, and I had been in the Red Sox dugout in the innings prior to that because only the Red Sox could win the World Series that night. It was Game 6, and they were up 3-2. So I was kind of at the edge of it waiting to do what we thought would be the championship interviews. And I was in the Dodger dugout when Kirk Gibson hit his home run in 1988. So I had pretty close to the best seat in the house for both of those moments that will never be forgotten. And I remember the first games I did for NBC on the Game of the Week and the first time I did the World Series or the playoffs on NBC because that had been what I dreamt of doing as a kid. Not so much any one moment, but just the idea that I'd been lucky enough to wind up where I had only been able to dream of being. Outside baseball, I guess the shot that Michael Jordan made to win the NBA championship in 98 for the Bulls against Utah, I called that with Doug Collins and Isaiah Thomas and some of the Olympics that I've done for NBC. Those would all be high on the list.
You've done so many things, but now that you're with the MLB Network, what's it like to be back doing baseball on a regular basis?
Well, the reason I left HBO, which is a broadcaster's paradise and which is the gold standard for quality in television, both in and out of sports, the reason I left HBO was baseball. That was the only thing that could have gotten me to leave HBO, but here was a chance not only to call some games, but to do unique baseball programming. It's only at the Baseball Network where we'd be able to do the kind of programs that we've done here at Cooperstown this weekend that will turn into off-season Studio 42s, where you get an hour with Reggie Jackson or Tom Seaver with a kind of depth and a kind of openness that you've never seen before, no matter how many times they've been interviewed. Or you get a series like the 20 Greatest Games that we just concluded, where you get the participants, managers and players from both teams to literally walk you through the games as you look at them again. And very often these players and managers have not seen these games in their entirety before, or they haven't seen them in 20, 30 years. And they're not just remembering it, they're almost reliving it as they see it. And you get insights that you couldn't otherwise get. There isn't any other place besides the Baseball Network where you'd get 2-3 hours to review the sixth game of the 1975 World Series with Johnny Bench and Fred Lynn. It's just, if you love baseball, this is paradise.
You've heard it mentioned in recent years that baseball has become a sport that really isn't so much made for tailored for TV, that it's gotten longer in some ways and a little bit more difficult to watch. One, would you agree with that? And two, is there a way to correct it?
Sadly, I would agree with it. I remain an avid fan of the game. But baseball's supposed to have a leisurely pace. That's part of its appeal. That has become a lethargic pace over the past generation. And that is not appealing. It's just hard sometimes to stick with a game when you're in the fifth inning and you're already 2 hours in, and even though the score is only 2-1, somehow it's moving along at this pace. You look at games from past eras, guys got in the box and they hit. I just saw an all-star at-bat because we played it back for Tom Seaver so he could recall it for us. Tom Seaver as a young pitcher in the 68 all-star game facing Mickey Mantle in his last year as a big league player. Mantle got up. He struck out on a 1-2 pitch, but there were only four pitches. I guarantee you the at-bat took less than a minute. The standing ovation took 2 minutes before he got into the batter's box. But he got in, and he stayed in. He had a swing and a miss. He stepped out for a second. He got back in. Boom. Seaver was on the mound. He threw. You know? Vin Scully said of Bob Gibson, he pitches like he's double parked. Seaver told me yesterday that when players make great plays behind pitchers, they happen disproportionately for pitchers who work quickly because it keeps the fielders in the game and it keeps them on their toes. The game needs to move with a brisker pace. Part of that can be controlled. Another part can't. No one's going to say, let's go back to a minute between innings for commercials. There's too much money in it. So television is, if you want to say, the culprit there. We plead guilty. But does everybody have to have their own theme song? And if they do, can it be played only once, like their first at-bat? Does a guy's personal theme song have to be played every at-bat? And does he have to wait to move from the on-deck circle to the plate until the theme song is over? And does he have to step out of the box between every pitch? You know? Does it have to take half a minute between pitches? I don't think so.
Well, I've heard there are rules on the books that would make a pitcher work faster. Is it just a matter of enforcing these rules?
Yeah, when there's no one on base, mm-hmm. there is a rule, sometimes enforced, sometimes not. And baseball is concerned about picking up the pace of games, but no matter what they try to do, it seems like they can only trim an average of 2 or 3 minutes off each game. I don't know what you can do when there are runners on base, because obviously if the pitcher is made to throw in a certain period of time, the base runner will figure it out and take off, and then you and I could steal second base under those circumstances. But when there's nobody on base, they ought to enforce it strictly.
Bob, we'll get you out of here with this one. You've done so much in sports. Is there anything, whether it be in broadcasting, TV, reporting, that you haven't gotten a chance to do that you'd really love to do?
Well, in sports, there's one thing, and I really have no claim on it because I'm not a golf expert. The only golf I do is the U.S. Open for NBC, which I enjoy doing. But I think the one event that everybody in sports recognizes as having a special cachet to it is the Masters. You know, now, there is no way in the world that CBS's coverage of the Masters would be enhanced by my presence. They've got it completely covered. Jim Nance is a golf guy. He knows what he's doing. But just to say that I was there, I wouldn't mind, you know, doing the 16th hole one day. You know, just to say that I did a Masters and put that check next to the items that are on the bucket list.
Bob, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Now, I checked this one off. I've been on with you guys.
You've been on WFUV.
So that's
one
less.
Thing off the bucket
that's one
list.
Less. There you go.
So we've helped Bob Costas achieve one of his goals today by having him join us.
One of my prouder moments.
Exactly. Your trip to Cooperstown has been redeemed.